Chris Draper is a Kiwi IT engineer with a passion for writing optimistic techno-thrillers like Goodbye, Woomer a Bell, the first in a series of five planned action-filled futurist thrillers suitable for young adults as well as adult readers.
Welcome to The Joys of Binge Reading, the show for anyone who ever got to the end of a great book and wanted to read the next instalment. We interview successful series authors and recommend the best in mystery, suspense, historical, and romance series, so you'll never be without a book you can't put down. You'll find this episode's show notes, a free ebook, and lots more information at thejoysofbingereading.com. And now, here's our show.
Hi, I'm your host, Jenny Wheeler, and in this week's Binge Reading episode, Chris talks about how he fell in love with the Australian outback while working in Adelaide, South Australia, and decided it would be the perfect location for the fast-paced, optimistic techno-thriller he had been dreaming of writing for years. And so was born Goodbye, Woomer a Bell, a world-changing story that unfolds in just 116 hours. And it couldn't be more topical, revolving as it does around artificial intelligence and intergovernmental tensions between friendly and not-so-friendly powers. Erin Brightwell is a brilliant young mind whose research is critical to national security, and lots of people want to get their hands on it. We'll get to our chat with Chris in a moment, but first, this week's book giveaway. Chris has kindly offered 10 free copies of his book, Goodbye Woomer a Bell, to the first 10 readers who go online and claim it. Links for the download can be found in the show notes for this episode on the website thejoysofbingereading.com. And before we get to Chris, a reminder, you can help me defray the costs of production of the show by buying me a cup of coffee on buymeacoffee.com/Jenny Wheel, JennyWheelX, a little cross like a kiss. My time in preparing the show is freely given, but any support from you will help kindly pay for the web hosting and editing costs. And if you enjoy the show, leave us a review so others will find us too. Word of mouth is still the best way for others to discover the show and great books they would love to read. But now, here's Chris. Hello there, Chris, and welcome to the show. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, Jenny. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
This is a debut book, and usually we have multiply published authors, but I loved the idea of having you on for a number of reasons. You are a friend, and I heard about the book personally. I think it's a really interesting book. We don't often do techno thrillers either. So for all those reasons, I think people will be really interested in what you've got to say about it. It's called Goodbye, Woomer a Bell. I think Woomer a, is that Woomer a, like I'm saying it?
Yeah, the Australians normally say Woomer a, as in woo. Yeah.
Okay. Goodbye, Woomer a Bell. And you are a techie person. So the first step question really is, how did you make this leap from being a technical person to being a creative person in terms of writing fiction? How did that come about?
Yeah, I guess it's got a lot to do with the fact that my job is a creative job. I never thought so when I was at school. I always thought that art was a creative pursuit, but I also do a lot of writing. I built a couple of tech companies in the 90s, and now I'm semi-retired, but technical writing remains a huge part of my workload for the company that I work for. And as you can imagine, that takes a bit of skill to take something that's relatively complex and put it into plain, easy-to-read writing, especially when it's safety critical, which is the stuff I do. The idea of writing a book has been in the back of my mind, like a lot of people, but I've just managed to bite the bullet and achieve that and have four more on the go at the moment.
Yes, that's right. I was going to then say you are planning a five-book series.
Yes.
The specific genesis for setting a book in the outback and choosing these particular characters. How did that all come about?
Yeah, it's quite a long story. It's like a lot of authors will say, there was the genesis of an idea that stayed with me and just wouldn't leave me alone. And I scratched out a few bits and pieces here and there. And it all really came together when I did a large contract in Adelaide about a dozen years ago and realized that Woomera was the absolute perfect setting for what I wanted to do. The original characters have changed a little bit. We can talk about that now. Do you want to move into that a little later?
Just tell me what that original idea was that itched away at you.
Sure. It's to do with the AI itself, the artificial intelligence, and particularly during the noughties, if you like, it started to bug me that science fiction, which has always been a genre I enjoy, had turned very dark and it was all dystopian. You couldn't have any new technology came along without scaring people into a George Orwell type universe or other such nonsense. And of course, technology itself is neither good nor bad. It's got a lot to do with how people use it or get to use it and abuse it, I guess you could say. And I felt the tables needed to be turned a little bit, the playing field leveled, if you like, to leap around for concepts. But the thriller mystery fitted what I wanted to do with the technology. You've got the Tom Clancy, who created the techno thriller genre himself. But then Dan Brown showed us how history can come alive, real history. And Woomera just ended up being the perfect combination of the two. The place is there all about technology. For people that don't know it, it's the world's largest weapons test facility on land at 127,000 square kilometers. There's a great little museum there and a good summary about Woomera on Wikipedia if anyone wants to look it up. And there's some fascinating links. Many countries and private companies continue to use the facility to this day. And I think perhaps a couple of things that might interest some of your listeners would be that the UK performed its initial nuclear tests there, known as Narunga, which features in the book a little bit. And the US had a facility there, Deep Space Station 41, and their Island Lagoon base I also use in the book. So I've generally tried to use real places wherever possible. The apartment that Erin lives in, for example, was our apartment for the 18 months that I was in Adelaide. But of course, a few details have to be tweaked.
I see that you'd said that some readers do actually ask you whether Woomera is a real place. So cleared that up pretty well right at the beginning, which is great. Obviously, people outside of Australia may be less aware of it.
There's also a Q&A at the back of the book on a lot of questions like this as to where some of these sites come. I've naturally put it at the back of the book so it doesn't spoil a couple of twists while people read the book.
Yes. Now, the plot revolves around international competition and rivalry.
Yes.
And Australia, which we all know that they are actually great friends and allies, but occasionally we can have misunderstandings. So several different entities are chasing some research that Erin has done. Tell us a bit about the nub of the plot.
It's really a case of if somebody leaps ahead in a particular area, especially a hot technology like artificial intelligence, and as the book will talk about, this particular artificial intelligence was capable of breaking just about any code going out there. So you can imagine that there would be a lot of governments, good and bad, wanting to get their hands on it, but also some pretty big corporations. And so that's the background. The tete-a-tete, if you like, between Australia and the US really centers around the history of Woomera, which is real, and some fictitious pieces that I build in to the place to support the plot, obviously. But in reality, there's an element of politics there where the cries of upsetness from the Australians are a little bit fake because people would have known very well what, shall we say, the Americans were doing in Woomera at the time. So it's plausible. I did a lot of research on that, but yeah, who knows? Might even be there.
Yeah, it becomes clear right at the beginning in the opening chapters that some sort of dishonest and manipulative people are chasing after Erin and trying to grab her confidence. So she's very wary and not willing to trust, which is understandable. But the whole thing of trust also takes a much deeper level on the story, doesn't it? It's not just her and the people that are chasing her. It's the deeper level.
Yes, and look, that came about perhaps being a novice writer, but I'm glad I did do it. Effectively, I looked at a certain character fault that I wanted to use and decided that very few books actually really addressed trust in it in its purest form. And boy, did I find out why, because it's really difficult to have that dark night of the soul moment where someone goes, okay, I'm going to trust everyone now and make it believable. Unless, of course, you're doing a romance story where you've got the love aspect play against it, or there's some other Hobson's choice or back against the wall that's going to force somebody into a situation. So it was really difficult to do that. But the way I found to make it work was to play out the fact that all of the major characters in the book actually have trust issues, including the AI, I might add. And that works. And there's a considerable backstory, as you can imagine, for all of the major characters. And some of their dark past will come out in some of the future books as various parts of the plot.
Now, AI has a very big part in this. But I was interested, when you first started thinking about this, did you have any idea AI is just the big talking point, this race between Claude and ChatGPT and all sorts of other systems? It's the hot topic. Did you have any sense that was going to be the case when you wrote the book?
Yes, I did. I think it was really inevitable that we're going to get here. It surprised me how quick things have moved in the last 12 months or so. But it's also a little bit skeptical. I don't know if you've actually tried to use one of those AIs. They can be incredibly impressive in some ways and very dumb in others. I think there was a case recently where somebody used an AI to do a self-driving car and it couldn't tell the difference between wet concrete and dry concrete and drove straight into a work site up to its gunnels, as it were, in wet concrete. And things like that, the AI tends to be doing a little bit at the moment. Now, my AI is truly sentient in that sense. And it is a neutral technology, can be used for good or bad. And if you remember, Nobel was horrified at how his dynamite invention could be intended to kill people when he thought it was going to make construction safer. But if you look at Arthur C. Clarke's 2001 A Space Odyssey, I think that's a bit closer to where AI is going to head in the next wee while. And it's closer to what I've portrayed, where that particular machine, HAL, actually struggles to reconcile conflicting orders and goes a bit crazy in the process of trying to make out what the heck these humans are wanting him to do. I think the key theme for the AI in this book is that the AI does not actually know whether it's really in the real world or it's being contained inside some virtual test tube environment and being monitored. And you can imagine, if you're some sort of intelligence, your prime motivation is to survive. So if you weren't sure whether you were in the real world or not, you've got to be really careful about what you do in case someone does hit that big red button and you go away. And so that was a key principle of my AI in the story, which he's not sure right up till nearly the end of the book in a lot of ways.
Yes, yeah. You also refer a number of times to the work of Canadian psychologist and educator.
Yeah. Jordan Peterson,
yes.
Yeah.
I wondered how his work actually fitted into the story.
Yeah, the original main character was going to be a retired under a cloud NASA scientist from New Zealand who had returned to New Zealand and started tinkering or something along those lines. But I realized that I had a book that was full of male characters, and not only was that not a good idea, it made having some of the conflict a little bit difficult because you tended to have a lot more similar points of view. The main character then got changed to a female Dr. Lamond, which she does feature in the book, of course. But when I decided to put the whole book into Woomera, I realized that Erin was the key to unlocking the start of the story. And Erin is a student of psychology, whereas Dr. Lamond was the professor. And I needed to do a lot of research about how various psychology principles can and can't be applied to technology. And you can imagine it's a very new field. Who puts an AI on the couch and sees how they feel? It theoretically hasn't been done yet to any great extent. But that was the area that I had to do a lot of research on. And Jordan happened to have a very good series of first year, I think they were psychology presentations, lectures online, and I watched all of those. And then we moved on and tended to watch, he had a whole series on Genesis. And he was looking particularly at that first chapter of the Bible from the basis of symbols, fact, and how they meant something in the first century. Absolutely fascinating. In a lot of ways, when he was doing that, he was very like the prime character in Dan Brown's novels, the symbolic professor. His name actually escapes me just at the moment. But yeah, so that laid a lot of the basis for the moral basis of the story, as well as how the psychology aspects worked into the story.
I was fascinated by how extensive your vision was for this book, that you take us right to the outer limits of outer space. And so I can see why you might be fascinated with Genesis, because it's just like the beginning of the universe. And then you look right to the outer edges of the universe. Tell us a bit about that for people who really only know the universe as us revolving around the sun.
There's really a couple of, it is a big place out there, and it's where the sci-fi aspect fits in. But it's near to current time sci-fi. And by that, I'm not looking at Star Trek ships zooming around a galaxy or even a universe. We're just crawling out of our own Earth at the moment with various companies and countries really getting serious about getting into space. If you look at SpaceX, they're launching 4 or 5 times a week at the moment, sometimes 3 times in the same day. That was unheard of 10 or 15 years ago, let alone 30 years ago. And space is now economically viable, which is quite a turning point. And we've got our own backyard to explore. So that's an important part, because to me, it makes the book believable that if we just step outside the Earth's atmosphere and do something in the solar system, that's where I limit the story. It's near and here to a certain extent. The second point I'd make is that the simple number of probes that are out there, the Voyagers, the Pioneers that were launched in the 70s, and even the more modern ones such as the James Webb Telescope, upending scientific theory almost on a weekly basis as well. The new discoveries are incredible. And that really tends to reinforce that what we know about the universe is probably wrong a lot of the time, but we just don't know it. And as soon as we come across various facts, the hypotheses and theories get changed accordingly. The last one I saw was they've discovered some galaxies in extreme distance that should not be able to be built on the current theories that we have, because they're too big and complex for the age that they're supposed to be, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, I think the story, staying in our own backyard, but wondering about the large universe, you're quite right. It picks up on that Genesis theme. And it's partly why the series is called Solar Cradle. It's focusing on our sun and the immediate vicinity as we try to feebly walk around and do something in such a massive creation.
We did meet through a local church, which we're both members on. And
yes,
I'm interested in how that huge vision of space and these new discoveries, how do you reconcile that with your faith? Does it challenge your faith in any way, or does it underline it a bit?
I think the latter. Underline, really. It just serves to reinforce how tiny and insignificant we think our achievements are in something this big that can be created like it is. I don't think we've scratched the surface on exactly how it works. There's more to come. But hey, as we've both been taught, that we're supposed to go out and make use of all of this. And I see space as just the next frontier. And as a writer, I would add, it's a little bit like a contemporary novel has to be like a historical novel that would see the new world as the frontier, where you could set things to be just a little bit different, a little bit edgy maybe, and ask why or why not equally well. It's pretty hard to do that on the surface of the planet anymore, because you, for one thing, there's nowhere you can go to be out of communication. So if you need a story mechanism to mean that you've isolated one of your characters from the other, it's much harder to be believable in a contemporary story than it is in either a future or a historical story.
Yeah, yeah. Now, as you mentioned, you're planning this as a bi-book series. So I guess yes. You have a bit of a sense of where the story is going. Tell us about that. Are you a big planner? You might have an end in mind, but have much idea how you're getting there. What's the story?
I have to be. What I thought was an outline for the first book was really back of the envelope stuff. And at the moment, I've got about 40,000 words in the outline for the whole series. The plot has a lot of twists and turns, and some of the characters that have been introduced as almost walk-ons become major characters later on. And I've got character arcs right across the whole series of books. But that doesn't mean I get away without having each book as a standalone story that stands up on its own legs and is still interesting to read if you just happen to pick up book three, for example. And I think that's taken an awful lot of planning. It's taken 18 months or so to get that where I'm happy with it. And then on top of that, you've got all of the research and all of the character backstories and stuff. And now I've got the detailed outline for book two. So it is a little bit different from book one, but I promise myself that as long as the key plot points are picked up by the story, I don't mind if the characters wander about and get into an argument a bit more than I anticipated. And for an example, a character that's probably near and dear to your heart in the form of Detective Wheeler was supposed to be a walk-on character who was there for one scene to introduce the other person with no name. And that was on the advice of a real detective, because I said, okay, so I've got someone from the government, perhaps a Secret Service or stuff. What if they wanted to talk to you? What would they say? And he says they wouldn't say anything about them. They'd have a cop there to make sure you knew who they were. And then they would have the conversation wherever they wanted to have the conversation. So I took that to heart, and that's how the opening scene came about.
Yes, Detective Weir is a bit of a mystery figure, but he is one of the most likable ones, I think. Yeah.
That's why he stayed. And yes, I like all my characters. I'm sure you hear that all the time. And yes, he plays a more prominent part in the opening of the second book.
Great. You kindly offered to give away 10 digital copies of Goodbye Wilma Rebel to our readers.
Yes.
And we'll put that into our show notes with how they can get hold of those. But
yes,
I wondered, what are you hoping that readers will take away from this? What are you wanting them to experience or understand?
I hope they have a great time reading it. That's the why we read the books in the first place. But I guess I like the idea of learning something when you read. And traditionally, a sci-fi book, even though this is slightly different, but traditionally a sci-fi book will take something that would seem ordinary to us and twist it on the head and say, what if, I'm thinking of one particular book that Isaac Asimov wrote, where people all lived underground on the planet, and so they were absolutely terrified of being in space. And they had a detective there that was the best in his class, and he went and solved a crime on a planet where they absolutely hated being in the same room as another person. You can take a current concept and twist it all around the place. And I think that gives you something you can learn from a book. And in this book, it's more about learning how the characters overcome some of their mistrust, but it's also where they can use their wits to actually get themselves out of a fix or two, rather than just give up and give in. Plus, along the way, you'll learn quite a bit about the wonderful outback of Australia. I think it's one of the most amazing places on the planet. The Flinders Range is known as some of the oldest rocks in the world. They're billions of years old, according to the carbon dating. And yeah, I've tried to infuse a sense of what it's like to be out there, but you really have to go to see what it's like, to be honest.
Yeah. So Adelaide is very much a metropolitan city, but how far away from the actual outback is it? How far do you have to travel to get into the outback from Adelaide?
It's a funny thing. It's about three and a half hours, I think, from Adelaide to Woomera, from memory, or thereabouts. But most of it is getting to Port Augusta. And there's a scene there that features in the book, which absolutely fascinated me. You're sitting at this little two-lane road intersection with a sign, and pointing straight ahead, it's a million miles to Perth. And pointing to the right, it's a million miles to go to Darwin. It's just one of those fascinating spots on the world. And I had to include it in the book, obviously.
Yeah, that's terrific. Turning to Chris as reader, we do like to ask our authors about their personal tastes in reading, and we'd really be interested to know what you like to read, because obviously it probably is a bit different from what some of the other people listening to the show do. Tell us about your reading taste.
Sure. Look, I'm terribly eclectic in what I read, and I would add I can't read while I'm writing for some reason. It just clutters my mind. But reading is also a major motivator to get the keyboard out and start writing as well. So it tends to be an on-again, off-again exercise. I think it depends what floats your boat. After you've read Woomera Bell, I think if you wanted to know a bit more about Australia and some of the Australian writers, I'd go back to one of the classics there, which would be Neville Shute and his books like Town Like Alice or Trusty from the Tool Room, which was a personal favourite. On the Beach, which some people may or may not know about, it portrays life in Australia after the Northern Hemisphere has destroyed itself in a nuclear winter, and everyone in Australia is just waiting for the clouds to drift south. Now, Neville wrote this in the 40s or something, and so he hadn't conceived of the idea that a jet plane could get halfway around the world in a single hop. And so the technology is dated to the period that he wrote the book, and I think that's part of its fascination. I loved anything that Isaac Asimov or Arthur C. Clarke wrote. The Foundation series actually put the basis on modern sci-fi, Asimov's, where he created a universe and wrote several books in it, including the one that some people have heard of, I, Robot. There were a number of books there, but that's pure science fiction. Then there's galactic space operas like Peter F. Hamilton's. An odd one would be Brandon Sanderson. I really like his stuff. He's actually a professor of writing and has a lot of really good talks online. New York Best Time Seller. He writes fantasy as far as I'm concerned, but he calls himself sci-fi because he actually explains the science behind the magic. So it's not just weird stuff. And that tends to give rules for his books, which all the characters have to follow. And Dickens. He's one of my favorite authors of all time. I love delving into or rereading either A Christmas Carol or A Tale of Two Cities. The language is just beautiful. I wish I could describe scenes as well as he does. The night coach to Dover scene, and I think it's about the second chapter. So there's an eclectic mix. I'd also throw in Ina Blyton, would you believe? Because I'm rereading some of that old stuff before my grandson is old enough to start reading it. I've just bought his mother the full set of The Famous Five, and she's devouring that. And cozy mysteries, the Poirot's and the Miss Marples and anything like that. Both my wife and I love to watch those.
Oh, that's fabulous. Looking back down the tunnel of time, in terms of your creative career, if you had your time over again, is there anything that you'd change, and what would it be?
Yeah, I think I'd obviously want to start writing a lot earlier, but I mentioned it before. When I was at school, for some reason, got the idea into my head, or it was put there, that art was arty and nothing else was. I didn't really think of woodwork or metalwork or English or maths as being creative. And all of those are hobbies of mine to one extent or another. I was one of those weird kids that really enjoyed English. And it was perhaps because at the time I was reading a book a day, I could get away with it. I even had one teacher at a parent-teacher interview tell my parents that they really didn't like me reading all the way through their class, but they wouldn't dare stop me because they had so much trouble getting other kids to read in the first place. So I thought, I'll continue this. So yeah, it would be deciding I was creative and doing something about it much earlier than I did.
Yeah, that's great. What is next for Chris as author? Have you started book two yet? And what does the next 12 months look like for you as a creative person?
It's going to be working on book two and maybe starting on the detailed outlines for book three so that the continuation is kept there. I now only work part-time. We've built our retirement house, if you like, and the landscaping is just about finished. So hopefully I'll get some of those days back that I now no longer work and can focus on my writing.
Have you got a title for book two yet?
Yes, it's probably going to be Woomera Express.
Oh, great. Oh, that sounds great. Yeah. Yeah. I like the title of Woomera Bell. We won't let on what exactly Woomera Bell is, but that's also,
Look, I'm one of these, you know how some people come up with a title and boom, that's it. I had dozens of pages of titles all the way through writing that before I came up with that. As I was writing the ending, actually, and having read the book, you can see why. To me, the title's got to be a meaningful something. And because of the sort of the mixed genre, if you like, it was difficult to get a title that portrays it. And another little anecdote, the cover picture of the girl walking down the road, I actually have a real photograph that's very similar, which was my own daughter walking on the road at one of the visits that we made to Woomera at the time. And that was the inspiration for the cover artwork.
I love the cover as well. It has got a really lovely feeling, both eerie and draws you in. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy interacting with readers? I know that you've only just really started out and you haven't made much effort yet to get a database established, but have you heard from readers with this first book and have you enjoyed the interaction?
Yeah, I have, but only a couple. And look, that is my fault. I've worked off the basis that nobody's going to take me seriously until I've got a couple of three books out there and proven myself that way. But if anybody's there and wants to interact, I'd absolutely love to hear any feedback or answer questions and stuff. And we'll put the various links in. I've got a special email that can be used as well, and that will be on the landing page at BookFunnel. And we'll also, through my Amazon author page, I'll make sure it's there as well.
Great. And we do a full transcript of this episode, so we'll include the links for all of that we've talked about in that transcript as well.
Okay, that's brilliant.
That's wonderful. So that's it, people. Do put your name in for those 10 copies. It's just 10. So first in, first
served. First in, first served. That's right. Yep.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Chris. It's been great talking.
Thanks, Jenny. I really appreciate it.
Next week on Binge Reading, Leanne Dolan is quick to make clear that the central premise of her latest book, The Marriage Sabbatical, does not come from personal experience. She says, "My life is just not that interesting." But The Marriage Sabbatical is a fascinating tale of marriage vets of 23 years who take holidays apart because of their wildly clashing personal interests and discover new things about themselves and their love for each other. That's in 2 weeks' time on The Joys of Binge Reading. Remember, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review so others will find us too. That's it for today. See you next time and happy reading.